Okay. Oh, we have sound. Yes. Hallelujah. That was easy. Not. My daughter saw me on a class video I did from another class and said, "Dad, why do you have all these wires sticking out of your tie?" Feels crazy. Okay, any questions about last time before we launch ahead with what is normally week two of material? Okay, let's go. All right, we're going to do four things in the next two lectures. There are four really critical topics in cartography that we have to cover before we can move ahead with GIS. And those are dealing with a little bit about geodesy, about the size and shape of the Earth and its form, and I'll go over that today. We need to talk about map scale and the representative fraction and what that means for maps. It's often been said that GISs are scaleless. Oh, I'm out of the frame already. GISs are scaleless. They are not, but I will explain the implications of that statement sometime before the end of class today. Then we'll look at two other topics that are critical and very central to cartography. The first one is map projections. We'll take a look at part of that as well today. And then we'll finish with coordinate systems. And you know, the nice thing about coordinate systems is that they're beautifully standardized. And the terrible thing about coordinate systems is that they're beautifully standardized. So you just have to go over them, you know, and just cover them. But certainly the ones that you're likely to meet in terms of GIS. Things like Universal Transverse Mercator, Military Grid Reference System, the National Grid, and State Plane Coordinates. Those are sort of the big four that we really need to cover in addition to latitude and longitude. Okay, so that's a long preamble to this, and this is a lead-in, this is a twofer. In the last lecture we talked about how to find employment in GIS, and we pointed to some websites. We recently had this big report came out in Nature about the prospects put out by the Department of Labor about the prospects for employment in the future in geospatial fields. So here are the top few positions, and I'll point out two things. First, it's a list. It's an ordered list because it's by number of jobs likely, or number of jobs today. This was done in 2008, and the projected growth. And then down the bottom is the bottom line. Total employment in the geospatial field in 2008 was 857,000 people. That's a lot of people in the United States. And then projected growth is 339,900. That's about a half of the people that are currently in the field. But when you think that, I would say easily 60% of the people currently in the field are old fogies, and they're going to retire, you know, and take away all your Social Security before you get the chance to earn and pay in and get it in your retirement. That means a lot of jobs available in this field. That was just following up on the last lecture. But I also wanted to introduce the idea of a list. We live our lives around lists. It's one of the simplest ideas and most simplest concepts for organizing information. Information without organization is chaos. You know, try and find somebody's telephone number in a phone directory ordered by, say, zip code, and you're going to be in a lot of trouble. It's not doesn't make sense. Lists beg indices. The library would be absolutely worthless without the catalog. Okay, if we can't go in and find whether or not a book's been checked out or not, or where it is and what shelf it's on, the metadata about where a book is every bit as important as the content of the book. Okay, and that's an idea that you're going to see throughout information generally, and extremely important when we get to talking about geographic information. So lists are everywhere. They're phone listings, they're TV show listings, if anybody still watches TV these days. They are, which I can't, mine's been unplugged now. I'm having the house painted. Directories in business books, in catalogs, the lists and ordered lists are everywhere. So we use lists as one form of organizing data, organizing information. We can have lists that include numbers. If we do so, we can often include other types of information like text, pictures, maps. We usually do this in tables. So we can put an index value into a table, and then it becomes quite a useful thing. For example, whenever I want to send everybody in the class an email, I simply download the spreadsheet of all your registration data, highlight the column that says email address, and paste it into the right column for my email device. Then I can send you all in email all at the same time. So clusters of information called together that we aggregate, data that has a common purpose or a common meaning, we usually call this a database. So a database is a collection of information with a single function or a single purpose. And we're all going to be building databases in this class. We're all going to be using and seeing databases. Some databases are ginormous. Some are relatively small. They just contain the information that we need. So when we take this database of things that interest us, like the telephone directory, and put it into the computer, the only way we can do it is through files. Files are structured just buckets into which we can pour bits and bytes. And file systems, as we've often encountered on computers, are hierarchical. In fact, the very term files comes from the old days of taking a sheet of paper, put it into a manila folder, keep all your records for a particular topic together. That is a file. And where do we put it? We put it in a file cabinet, so that there are multiple files. And then we have trays in the file cabinet. We want to go to anything to do with conferences. You go to the top drawer, pull it out, go to the third file, and open it and take out the third piece of paper. So this idea of embedded hierarchy within files is absolutely essential. And it's there within Windows, within Apple's folder priorities and so on. Anytime you look up information, say you've stored some photographs or something on your iPhone, you need to go through folders or libraries and down into individual files and eventually to an individual record or one item that you're trying to find. So hierarchical file systems, essential. Now, many years ago when I first wrote this book, I said, how could you trim it down and make out something that's a very simple analogy to what a database system really does? And I, you know, my daughter was doing baseball then, and remembering baseball cards. I never collected baseball cards because I grew up in the United Kingdom, but if I'd have been here, I would have collected them. If we start with your standard shoebox full of baseball cards, it's not a bad analog to a database. So the shoebox by itself is a single unit. We can pick it up, carry it around, move it from one house to another. That is a database. It's pretty versatile. We pop the top off, we've got we've got individual records within it, and without any order, let's say we stuffed the cards in there by the order in which we got them, we wouldn't be able to find anything. We'd have to sort through the whole list just to find any particular player. It'd be much better if we filed it by team or by date or by player's last name or something like that. That way we could pull out a particular card, and once we have the card, it's still not the final level of disaggregate information. It's now a table. And the table contains all sorts of things. It's on the front end, back of the card, we've got perhaps a picture, we've got a team, we've got batting averages, we've got record scores, and so on and so forth. So all of this information collected together, all the files and pertinent attributes for any particular player is on that baseball card, and we can file it away neatly. But then it's not really a complete analogy, because we only have one way of organizing that database. If we suddenly woke up in the morning and said, oh my God, what was I thinking about doing it by player's last name? I want all my red cards at the front and all the black ones at the back. It's another perfectly legitimate way of organizing the cards, but it might take you a whole day just to do it. If we have a computerized database, we can reorder the information at will. So you don't have to sort by this attribute or that attribute. We can choose by any attribute that we want. So the computer is what makes all that possible. So my metaphor kind of broke down a little bit. So what does the database do? Well, it handles information storage. That's how we take the cards in the first place when we get them from the gum wrappers at the drugstore and insert them in. And there we're storing them in our database. Retrieval means finding exactly the card that I want, maybe one or more cards, and pulling them selectively out. That's a retrieval operation. I'm getting information back from my database to be able to do something with it. And then query is what the computer allows us to do. It allows us to answer or ask questions in ways that we didn't necessarily structure the data to answer the problems to begin with. So for example, we could say, well, it might be kind of interesting to see, how many players hitting more than 300 live within 100 miles of Pittsburgh, or something like that. You couldn't do that with your regular box of paper cards, but you could with a computer. And it would be geographic, because now we're drawing a circle around Pittsburgh and finding what other teams there are there and so on. Okay, so in a database, what do we actually store? Well, we don't need to know. We'll let the computer scientists worry about the actual nitty-gritty details of how the bits and bytes get shoved into the files. Logically, we can think of what's stored in terms of a very simple model. It's called a flat file model. And it includes the attributes stored as column headers and the records as rows. Remember in the last class I talked about the difference between objects, a sort of template, an empty holder that has all the properties of a particular thing, and then an instance, what it looks like when the thing actually gets put into the template, a real object. So we can have, you can imagine a blank baseball card, perhaps for some future player who's yet to play his first major league game. It already has the headings on the columns. It's already going to have a batting average and a home team and place of birth and all this sort of stuff. We just don't know the value yet because we don't have an instance of that object. Okay, each time we get a new card, it's going to become a new row in our database. It's going to add one more row to our table. The content of an attribute for any particular record, that's one row, is a value. And values can be very strange. Now, for example, the value blank or not applicable is a perfectly reasonable value. Okay. And there are many cases where you need to do that. Otherwise, it could be A or 10 or 42. So the value can be numerical or it can be text. Here's what a flat file looks like. It doesn't really matter what it looks like in terms of the computer itself. You can actually unravel pretty much any database file and see it look like this. Simplest way to do that is through the DBF format or any of the Excel export formats. What do we have? Well, we've got a table. It has columns, and the column headers are the names of the attributes. If this was your gold table, for example, it might have an attribute that's your name, the date you first registered for a class at UCSB, how many units you need to graduate, those kinds of things. The records are the entries in each of the rows. So in the gold database, that's each additional student. So each student has their own set of values across all of the attributes. And then the values, well, they can be all sorts of different things. They can be not applicable. They can be missing. You know, somebody never filled in the date you first enrolled at UCSB. Now, that could be a legitimate error, but there's still, we've got to deal with a missing value in that field. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they might be numerical values, alphabetical values, street addresses, anything like that. Now, I put this crazy slide in here to illustrate one point, one only point, and that is that attributes have units, okay? The numbers are not directly comparable to each other. So this is across the mountains here in a little town called Nukayama. So here, it's not actually the official Nukayama sign. It's kind of behind the high school, so you have to go looking for it. So they said the population is 562, the number of feet above sea level, 2,150, and it was established in 1951, and they put cynically underneath total, 4,663. Well, why is that 4,663 meaningless? Well, because you can't compare the units, one attribute across another one. So a unit that is name is not comparable with a unit that says height in feet. Okay? We can't add them together. We can't multiply them together. The computer may allow us to multiply them together, but the result we're going to get is gibberish. Okay? So applying the first rule of common sense is something we often have to do when we're combining attributes together. All right, so data in GIS must contain, this is what I hope I convinced you of in the last lecture, some reference to a map. And that can take the form of the data actually being on a map and therefore being captured and put inside the GIS. We'll deal with that in chapter 4. Or it can simply contain attributes within the table, within the flat file that are latitude and longitude, or some other coordinate system. We'll cover the full range of coordinate systems next lecture. Let's, for the moment, assume that it's latitude and longitude. Now, the GIS is going to cross-reference the attribute data with the map data and allow searches based on either or both. So let's say we wanted to retrieve all the points on a map inside a certain rectangle. Let's, for now, just assume that it's a rectangle of latitude and longitude, like a 7.5-minute quadrangle map from the USGS. Then if we know the longitude of this side of the map, longitude of this side of the map, and the latitude of the here and here, we can say just find all the points that fit inside all those four numbers. And that will give, sure enough, it will give me all the features in the database that fall inside that range. That's a very simplistic way to search. It's called a bounding rectangle search, but we'll cover that in more detail later on. Okay, and the cross-reference between the two, remember the attributes, is going to be a link. And I'm not going to tell you this today, but as we meet data structures for maps a little later on, we're going to realize that geography only really fits into the flat file model well when we're dealing with points. As soon as we get lines, areas, or more complex features, it just kind of falls apart on us, and we have to come up with smarter ways of storing the geography. More about that later. Okay, cartography, my first love. Understanding the way maps are encoded to be used in GIS requires knowledge of cartography. You wouldn't know that for some people that work on the theoretical end of GIS, but I always argue that it's the foundation upon which everything else stands. What is cartography? Well, it's the science that deals with the construction, use, and principles behind maps and mapping. And that includes things like their reading and interpretation, their visual design. And what is a map in that case? Well, it's a depiction or all a part of the Earth or some other geographic phenomenon as a set of symbols. We talked about symbols last time, how features can be represented by symbols, and at a scale whose representative fraction is less than 1:1. A map at 1:1 is the same size as the thing that it represents. So the symbols are just a confusing re-rendering of reality, like a cardboard cutout of a person instead of a person, let's say, at 1:1. We're not really interested in maps at scales like 1:1. It's much better if we can reduce large areas to a small space so that we can fit, say, a whole county or a whole state or the entire world onto the computer screen that we're going to have available for mapping. All right, so this leads me into geodesy. I always call this the first transformation because we begin with the Earth in its entirety, and I used to think it was pretty large, but the older I get, I realize it's not that large. Certainly we have the capacity to destroy it within a single lifetime. That's not that large, I guess. Taking that and rendering it through the scale transformation scales it down to a manageable size. But the first thing we need to do is to actually figure out what shape we're going to match it onto. And that shape is very much has to do with geodetic models and map projections, the two parts of that transformation equation. So there are many ways we can actually assume a shape for the Earth. The simplest one is to assume a sphere, which is what we do when we go and buy a globe, say in the bookstore. Trust me, they don't make the globe perfectly proportional to the actual Earth shape. They just make a sphere and print it with a map that makes it look like a globe. So a sphere is a very simple model. And the sphere actually has some distinct advantages for cartography. We'll discuss a few in a minute. Another model is the oblate ellipsoid. And what the heck does that mean? I'll be explaining that in just a second. Or sometimes called a spheroid, because an ellipsoid is actually a little bit more complex geometric shape than a spheroid. Another model that becomes increasingly important, depending upon your mapping application, is the geoid. And I'm going to briefly touch on the geoid today because it only has context for cartography and GIS at extreme, so I call it extreme mapping, very high accuracy mapping or very detailed space trajectories and that sort of thing. And then, of course, we often model the Earth as a flat surface. If I asked you to make a sketch map of this room on a sheet of paper and gave you 10 minutes, you'd probably all assume that this room was flat. You wouldn't begin to think that you'd need to account for the curvature of the Earth from there to there. But as we'll see today, it does make a difference. If you built a bridge that was completely flat, it would fall down. But of course, I have to give equal time to all philosophies in my teaching. And there's a book I've referenced, I believe it's referenced in the text, but if not, I can email you the reference, about the history of the idea of the flat Earth, because you probably learned in your history lesson in grade school that Christopher Columbus got in his three boats and sailed off fully believing he was going to drop off the edge of the Earth. Hogwash. Absolute hogwash. The idea of a flat Earth was invented in the mid-19th century by a crazy Englishman called Samuel Rosebottom. I'm not making this up, folks. He convinced enough other people, and it formed a movement, a sort of religious political movement, that actually spread to the United States and influenced actions here in the United States, too. The last living remnant of Samuel Rosebottom's legacy is the Flat Earth Society. And yes, indeed, it does still exist. It completely died out in the 1980s, and then somebody just decided that they were going to become the new president and put up a new website. So I do not want to prevent you from this, but they have put online the entire Zetetic philosophy, dated 1867, by Samuel Parallax Rosebottom, and his views on the universe. And if you want a good laugh after a few beers on a Saturday night, just look that up. Okay. More than that, the actual flat Earth ideas, if you do look them up and go back in history, are really very simplistic. So Homer, Herodotus, many of the early classics assumed a very simplistic model of the Earth as a flat disk surrounded by the world ocean, Oceanus, and with a bulb over the top, because they didn't have a clue why it should be a sphere and why it should be flat in the middle, who knows. This is, if you want to see the history of this, take a look at this book by a former historian here, Geoffrey Russell, who wrote this book, Inventing the Flat Earth, Columbus and the Modern Historians. Interesting philosophy. Well, so much for equal time. From now on, you're just going to have to take me on trust, although I can prove what I'm saying. So two models for the Earth's shape. The simplest is a sphere. What's a sphere? Well, it's a surface dictated by an equal radius from a central point, all possible loci of that point around it. The radius for the Earth is about 6.5 million meters. That means a very convenient fact that if you go all the way around the Earth, you've traveled 40,000 kilometers or 4 million meters. And that's almost correct, almost because they made that value up before they really knew the true size and shape of the Earth. But secondly, that was the original definition of a meter. A meter was 1/10 millionth of the distance between the equator and the North Pole on the meridian passing through Paris. Why Paris? We'll see in just a minute. Once we realized that it wasn't perfectly spherical, there was then a rush to learn what exactly the size and shape was. A whole series of measurements that eventually gave us, up to date, more than 40 or 50 additional, increasingly accurate measurements that have allowed us to converge on something called the spheroid, or often called the ellipsoid. A spheroid is an ellipse rotated around its shorter axis. Okay, well, let's do a little bit of history. As you see, I love history lessons. The oblate ellipsoid was predicted by Newton because he was working on gravity at the time, and he figured that if you had a rotating sphere and it was pliable in any way whatsoever, over time the equators would bulge out and the poles would be pulled down. So it would get flatter at the top, fatter around the equator. That has an important implication that I'll explain in just a second. At that time, there was really only one good accurate measurement of the length of a degree of latitude measured along a parallel. And that was the Paris meridian in France. The Cassinis, in fact, three generations of the Cassini brothers, had taken measurements starting around Paris, but then eventually extending all the way to Dunkirk on the northern border of France, all the way down to Perpignan, right down on the southern Mediterranean border of France. And when they did the calculations, degree by degree, they found against their expectations that the distances of a degree were getting shorter as they went from the Mediterranean to the English Channel. Well, that would imply that the Earth had the shape called a prolate spheroid. That's kind of like the shape of an egg. You know, it's got pointed top, pointed bottom, and it's flatter at the equator. So Newton was predicting the exact opposite, predicting something that looks more like a pumpkin, which squished down fatter around the edges. So the French Academy of Sciences, to attack this thing, it was the major scientific problem of this era. Hundreds of people worked on this. They said that what they needed was to supplement the data that they had, Cassini's data from Paris, and they needed to send out two expeditions. One would have to go to somewhere where the latitude was very high, ideally up on the Arctic Circle, and they chose Lapland, modern-day Finland, and then they needed something fairly near the equator, and they chose Peru, and now what's part of Ecuador, and they sent out two expeditions. Each was going to measure a length of a degree of latitude along a parallel of longitude. Just measure it on the ground, literally, stick over stick, and figure out exactly how long it was. Well, not quite stick over stick, but you'll see in a minute. This resulted in two expeditions, and this is just, you know, I could give whole courses on these two expeditions, let alone 5 minutes of one lecture. But it reduced to two. La Condamine, although he wasn't in charge, it became the leader, and was sent to a place called Mitad del Mundo, means the middle of the Earth, in what was then Peru, is now Ecuador. And he came along with somebody called Bouguer, who's probably well known if you've done any physics. And, well, long story short, they had a terrible falling out on the outbound journey. They wouldn't talk to each other, so they set up to do the experiment twice, independently, and they overachieved. They measured 3 degrees instead of 1 degree, and as a result, La Condamine didn't get back to Paris for 8 years. How's that for an experiment? Much simpler was Maupertuis, Moreau de Maupertuis, who was sent to the Tornio River Valley in Finland, and was sent to measure 1 degree, which he did probably faster because he was working in the Arctic winter and it was a bit cold. Maupertuis was the first to get his results back. He got a little bit of a lead on getting started, and he was in Europe. So even though he got shipwrecked on the way home, he kept his records and so on. I told you, you can't make this stuff up. Got back to Paris and reported his result. He reported that the degree that he'd measured was actually just a little bit short of a degree, but we'll give him that benefit of the doubt, was 57,437.9 toises. Now, what the heck is a toise? Well, it's a measurement unit that was used before the French Revolution when they standardized on the meter. A toise is 1.949 meters, one of those facts that probably you will remember for 32 seconds and then forget for the rest of your life. The Cassini measurement in Paris was that a degree was 57,060 toises. So the conclusion was that the Earth was flatter at the poles, and this meant that Newton's figure, the oblate ellipsoid, would be correct rather than the prolate. Well, the measures were wrong. In fact, all of the calculations were wrong, but they were within a margin of error that meant that conclusions were absolutely correct, that they had indeed deduced or measured, scientifically tested correctly, the fact that the Earth was an oblate ellipsoid. And Maupertuis published his famous book, La Figure de la Terre, 1738. Immensely influential book. Now, that's it on the left-hand side. The figure of the Earth determined by observation. That was a revolution in itself, that you went out and measured things to study them. By Messieurs Maupertuis, etc., etc., etc. So you might notice that they were accompanied by Monsieur Celsius, professor of astronomy at Uppsala, local Swede who was involved. You probably know him because he probably learned a lot about being cold on this expedition. Had a whole career in temperature and eventually got a temperature scale named for him. On the right-hand side is the Condamine's narrative. One of the reasons it took 8 years to get back to Paris was that after the fight, they decided to come home different ways. Bouguer went back and sailed back up through Panama, because there was no Panama Canal then, had to trek across land. La Condamine and his colleague Gaudin, who was nominally the lead of the expedition, decided instead that they would go all the way down the Amazon River and go back by crossing the Atlantic, which in fact they did. And in fact, it was their observations of the Amazon that actually had equal weight to their discoveries of the length of a degree. So they said, a journal of a voyage made by order of the king to the equator in order to measure 3 degrees of the meridian. So this was three times as good, right? Now this is kind of a fact that's a little hard to comprehend. Why does, when it gets flatter, do the lengths get longer? Well, the reason is that when we measure latitude and longitude on the Earth, we take as our standard, we get a heavy weight and hold it out on a piece of string, and it points down, and we assume that that's down, and that's pointing to the center of the Earth. Well, in fact, it isn't pointing to the center of the Earth. It is if we happen to be standing directly on the North Pole or directly on the equator, it's pointing to the center of the Earth. But anywhere else, it's pointing to some other point that's on that common axis. Okay. So the net effect of this is that as we get further and further into the higher latitudes, the ground distance associated with 1 degree of latitude gets longer and longer. And you can see this by looking at tables. It's quite a bit of difference. Here's Maupertuis's map. You notice that the method he used was called triangulation. In other words, he set up a series of stations where he put a surveying instrument where he could see other positions. He measured the angles between those. He could then use this huge set of triangles to calculate the lengths of all the sides and all the angles. He'd measured the angles. And the last thing he had to do was lay out a baseline. So they needed a line as long as possible in a dead straight line. They decided the flattest thing they had was the River Tornio itself, frozen solid. So in the snow, they went end over end with a rod, marking out 14.3 kilometers in a direct straight line, marked the two endpoints of that, and included them into the triangulation. Now they could solve all the distances within the system and accordingly measure the length of a degree. You can just see the triangles marked out on the map there. So they used the principle of triangulation, and I've already mentioned Anders Celsius as my salute to him. Okay, so what have we discovered since? Well, basically, they got it kind of right, and we've just made it slightly more accurate ever since. So this is a handy number to remember, is that the Earth is 40 million meters in circumference, approximately. Depends, obviously, where we measure it. That's for the meridian passing through Paris. It's slightly different if we take any other meridian or any other great circle. But it's going to be within a tolerance. It's a good number to remember, 40 million. That means it's 10 million from the equator, to the pole, 10 on each of the four quadrants. If you divide that up into degrees, 360 degrees, it means that each degree covers 111,111 meters on the ground. So another handy number to remember. It's all ones, six ones in a row. We've already met the ellipsoid. It's an ellipse rotated in three dimensions about its shorter axis. So if we actually drew an ellipse like this, it has two axes. They're of different lengths. It's really hard to draw circles, let alone ellipses on the board. But imagine now that I could pick up this chalk and spin it around that axis, and the three-dimensional form that it would make would be an ellipsoid. Okay? It's flatter up here, more curved and bulkier out that way. So since the 1700s, we've been measuring that ellipsoid over and over again, increasingly more and more accurately. It's actually only about 1 in 300, or actually 1 in 298, off of a sphere. So it's the sphere is not a bad model at all. The difference in the actual circumference, if you went pole to pole, that way versus that way, is only 42 kilometers. Well, it's all of 42 kilometers. That's quite a lot of difference when you think about it. Lots of ellipsoids have been measured. Why? Because every time somebody started mapping a particular country, they wanted to get the best ellipsoid that would match their country. So everybody chose their own ellipsoid. A country like China would choose a huge one that averaged things out over large areas. Something like Denmark would choose a much smaller one, obviously. A little bit more detail. In fact, it probably wouldn't matter whether they chose an ellipsoid or a sphere. Countries that are elongated north-south, like Chile, are going to choose a different one than countries that elongated east-west, like the United States. So many mapping programs have been based on each. Examples chosen are things like NAD27, which was actually not, it was an ellipsoid, but it wasn't based on the center of the Earth. WGS84 and GRS80, those are three very important ellipses.